Warning, you are about to listen to the greatest radio show ever. And due to contractual obligations and to shield our airwaves and corporate licensees from any semblance of liability, responsibility, and gullibility, we must tell you the views represented on this show are not necessarily those of this station or its management. This radio show contains differing points of view on current political topics, and due to the nature of its contents, it should be heard by everyone. Thank you for listening. 3, 2, 1. Now live from the Devil Radio Studios in Madison, Wisconsin, where the political party is just beginning. Welcome to the Devil's Advocate Show. Friends proving it's never personal, only politics.
Please allow me to introduce myself.
Here is your host, Mike Crute.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, Hour 2 of the Paperwork Crimes Wednesday edition. We are joined right now by a fine guest. He is former U.S. Attorney James Santel. Jim, welcome back to the show. Fortunately, it hasn't been too long since we saw you last, Jim.
It has not been. Another day when lawyers take center stage in the news of America.
Well, it can't be a good day for America then, but... Let me ask you, this latest filing from the Department of Justice, you know, I know you were up late night reading it, texting it, trying to inform dumb guys like us. Something big's happening here. The DOJ sort of went out of their way to make a public rebuttal of Donald Trump. Hell, I would say they almost made a criminal case against Donald Trump in public. What was your interpretation of this filing?
They really did. I join you in that assessment, Mike. This was a situation where Donald Trump had filed a lawsuit to do one simple thing, presumably. That was to get the judge to appoint a special master to look at all these documents that the FBI had seized, apparently not trusting the Department of Justice. Department of Justice had previously said in the affidavit, no, we've got that. The judge had approved it, the magistrate judge. That process had gone ahead. All the department needed to do today was to say, you know what? We've done this already. Work is already accomplished. Nothing to do here, Judge. We oppose the special master. Nothing for that person to do. That would probably have taken maybe a page with the signature lines. To your point, what they did instead is they added an additional 36 or 37 pages, all but indicting the president for this conduct. And from my perspective, preparing the United States of America for that time when Merrick Garland does, in fact, return before a grand jury an indictment against the former president.
Jim, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. It certainly felt that way, perhaps 1,000 words and at least 3 criminal charges. It seemed like the criminality was laid out visually for the American people. Did you share that in interpretation, Jim? We didn't see the contents, but we saw the cover letters.
Right, we sure did. And we saw two or three very important visual things. One, of course, is the photograph itself. If you choose not to read all 36, 37, 38 pages of it, the picture is probably on the front covers of every single newspaper across the country today. It shows the criminality. The picture is the crime, if you will, as some people have said. It shows the random, haphazard, scattered way in which highly sensitive documents were handled at Mar-a-Lago. And plainly, near the president's own desk, the things he was working at the time. And beyond that, then, the other stunning thing coming out of this affidavit is the letter from the attorneys back in the summertime saying, nothing to see here. We've given you everything pursuant to the subpoena. Do not come into the search warrant. We know now that as a result of the search warrant, the FBI acquired two times as many documents as they ever had before. Those lawyers are in some big jeopardy themselves today.
Jim, there is an article, a column at the Washington Post today that puts forth the theory that Donald Trump used to travel around with a big stack of thousands of pages, everything from top secret documents to newspaper articles to whatever the luncheon menu was going to be today on Air Force One. And he'd carry around these stacks of paper, and it was sort of a dual reason. He wanted to feel important. You know, he wanted to look busy. Well, the president's got all this stuff to work on Air Force One. It's being suggested that perhaps he's sort of a hoarder and he took big stacks of this stuff back to the Mar-a-Lago resorts. Jim, if that were the case, if there's no actual espionage, he's not selling secrets, but he's just this disorganized hoarder sort. Would that somehow diminish the crimes alleged and documented by the photographs in the DOJ's very thorough filing?
I'm taking my lead from Don, who's already shaking his head, I can see. And so I'm going to go with that alternative theory, which has two problems with that. One is go back to the photograph. On those red cover pages, anybody who's worked in government, when I was U.S. attorney, I saw this fairly routinely when I was in Iraq all the time, screaming at you at the top of its colorful lungs. This is sensitive material. This is classified. You cannot take it away from your desk without putting it in a safe for 10 minutes. That's how serious this is. That's number one. Number two, if indeed this was just purely completely random, and gosh, I forgot what I've got with me, then you've got to respond to it back in January completely. Oh, by the way, you've got to respond to a grand jury subpoena over the summertime, in which once again, there's a request for this material. And finally, when you don't do it, your lawyers are pretty much stuck. They're saying, oops, I guess we kept some additional stuff here. That's when this goes from pure negligence and pure inadvertence to a criminal conduct situation.
So I'm going to put you down for paperwork crimes, counselor.
Right. I'm just on this side of that category, Mike. That's where I'll go.
James Santel, former U.S. attorney, friend of ours, Jim. Thanks for coming around once again. Attachment F. That was the last page that I saw. I actually did read it, and it's quite stunning. And I just want to go start from the beginning, Jim. His attorneys, sat on their ass for a couple weeks or were, bumbling around, did not do anything really afterwards. And then he filed this request for a special master. But it wasn't in the proper jurisdiction. It was under a different judge or something, Jim. And my understanding is because it was not, they had to, the DOJ had the opportunity to enlighten the new judge as to the circumstances that the old judge was already aware of. And that gave them, the opportunity to do this 38-page indictment of Donald Trump. Do I have that right? Is this because his lawyers screwed up?
Yeah, I think you can say that they screwed up in two ways. One is, as you said on Monday, again, this is the calamitous clown car of Donald Trump's lawyers. As you say, getting the judge wrong, getting the filings wrong, invoking improper statutes. These are the kinds of things that maybe wonderful real estate lawyers would do, but not in a criminal setting. So they get it wrong initially. The government plainly sees its opportunity here to not only educate in the wake of those fairly bungling missteps, the judge gives them another opportunity. And then the Department of Justice does something else. And this is why it sort of signaled, as you say, in the attachment there. The Department of Justice goes back and says, we'd like permission, judge, to go beyond the page limit for our response to this. And the judge very quickly grants that. That should have been a strong indication to everybody that, whoa, there's something else coming here, not just in the wake of the negligence and the mishandling and the bad, incompetent behavior of the lawyers, but also we've got a whole lot more. We're going to walk through this door now, and we're going to, frankly, strategically take advantage of the stupidity of these lawyers in filing the lawsuit in the first place, getting it wrong procedurally, and advocating for a special master when there was no need to do it at all.
Jim, the Department of Justice made a specific request to do extra credit before the court?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In all these rules, there is, and every single time you file something, there's a page limit because judges got tired of all of us lawyers writing too much and saying too much. Imagine that, right? And so you've got limits, and there are situations where if you overdo the page limit, courts will bounce it back and say, sorry, can't do that. And so you can get permission under appropriate circumstances to extend that page limit. The judge very promptly said, sure, go ahead. Tell me what more you want me to know about. And that's exactly what the government did here, again, signaling exactly what we got, which is, as you said at the top of the hour here, this is almost a talking indictment now of Donald Trump. Plainly, Merrick Garland preparing us for what is about to come.
James, obstruction. I mean, this is Donald Trump. If he was the hoarder in chief, he had every opportunity, every ample opportunity to make it right. And he declined to do so multiple times. And then apparently at some point, took stuff out, intermixed it with other things. They found some of this stuff in the drawer of his personal desk with his passports. One of the reasons those were swept up in this is because they're in the same drawer as some top secret materials, Jim. Let me ask you this. I know Crudy everybody likes to brush this aside and compare it to the lack of the peaceful transfer of power, Trump's insurrection, and that whole thing. Now, my understanding,
a much more substantial crime, I would allege, but
maybe as it stands right now. But we have multiple grand juries, multiple investigations going on. It's not the same people in all these different spots, although it's all under the DOJ. So I guess my question is, Jim, if guys like me and understand how Trump's psyche is, I believe he took these for a reason. He took them and did this for a reason. He obstructed justice for a reason. Because he finds value in the documents that he ultimately kept. At what point in an investigation like this would the DOJ have to start looking at, well, okay, did he do anything with these documents? One thing to have them. How does the Department of Justice make the next logical step in my mind to say, well, what's our exposure here? I know the DNI is doing something, but how does the DOJ do that?
Right, and much like the DNI, again, pursuing this investigation of just what the harm has been. You got it just right, Dom, that there is a part of the government, if you will, figuring out what things were compromised, what things could have been compromised out there. Inside the Department of Justice, there's a thing called the National Security Division. It's certainly pursuing the same kinds of things and asking those questions. Okay, he's got these documents. They're scattered around the floor on the colorful carpeting there. They're next to his passport, which suggests, again, these are things he's looking at. What kinds of possibilities could there be? And then it goes to the issue of intent, which you've talked about before, right? It wasn't just gathering these things up. What was he doing with them? Why were they scattered on the floor? Why are they on his desk? And that's what the department will also be looking to. And presumably going back to some of those same people who provided the probable cause for the affidavit and asking them, what was he doing with this stuff?
Well, Jim, I would just say quickly, I think my impression was that those were put on the floor and they took pictures to present that. That's my impression. I don't know if that's the case or not, but that seems to be staged for the purposes of this, looking and see there. The little measurement thing was there.
Sure, right, absolutely. But the point is that even on in that photograph, as they described in the accompanying affidavits, the supporting memorandums, they found them in various locations. They were not simply in this room. They were scattered about with his personal materials, other things that were not plainly not classified, just presidential records, all of that scattered notion. They're not just sitting in boxes somewhere. He's using them for some purpose. And my sense is that photograph reflects that.
Come back with us and our fine guest, James Santel, former U.S. attorney. You're listening to The Devil's Advocates.
From what I've heard, you're using your paper not for writing, but for rolling doobies.
Was that wrong? Should I not have done that?
The Devil's Advocates. Sausage making never looked so good.
We are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show. James Santel, former U.S. attorney, sticking around at least for one more segment. Jim, so with these documents, again, I didn't quite hear. I want to pin you down on this. What would have to happen for the DOJ to inquire further about why, and does it matter, why Donald Trump had these and what he did with them? What does that look like?
Right. It does. And as you just got just right again, Dom, there's undeniably a grand jury that's looking at. They're the ones who issued the subpoena over the summertime asking for these documents. We don't know whether people testified before the grand jury. It's entirely possible that some of the people who are represented in all that redacted stuff in the affidavit, they may have also appeared there. And so to the extent that the Department of Justice is looking for a motive and intent here, which they necessarily need to do, is if we do in fact proceed with this prosecution, yes, it's a crime to do this. You also need to tell a jury why it is. What was the motivation of the defendant to do this? So they've got to come up with a theory, and it's got to be premised upon facts and information that would come from a lot of the people who saw these documents as they're being moved around Mar-a-Lago. That would come from people who saw the former president with them. We also know that there are some surveillance tapes out there. I don't know exactly where those are, if they were exterior, interior. Presumably, they showed a lot of interior things as well. So you look at that, too. But your point is the all-important one, which is, in addition to charging what are plainly more than just technical, with all due respect, more than just the paper violations, you do need to tell a jury that this was not simply negligence, that there was a purpose behind it. Whether or not he actually consummated some engagement with a foreign power, compromise, that's different. It's a slightly different issue. If you still have the intent to do something with them, that's what you need to tell a jury about. And you'd get that through the testimony of grand jury, people appearing in front of the grand jury, and presumably, maybe even some of the notations, some of the other personal records and notes that maybe the president or others made about these things, all that could be and should be a part of the department's inquiry right now.
Jim, let me ask you to timing. We got midterm elections in approximately 90 days. And the Department of Justice doesn't like to seem political in their timing. So if you drop this within, 60 days, an indictment against the former president of the midterms, there's going to be all sorts of squeals of politics. The guy's endorsed half the candidates in America, more or less. So, A, this timing factor in, Jim, and B, back to my theory, or at least someone else's theory, maybe it's just a hoarder, maybe just took this paperwork back. And certainly we know, because I saw the photos, you saw the photos, Jim, he's guilty. We know he's guilty. But are these the sort of crimes that a former president's going to go to prison for? And if not, aren't there bigger fish to fry, Jim? Don't we have the whole insurrection issue and the guilt of the former president in that regard? To me, that's the more significant crime for history to judge this former president by, not whether or not he took paperwork of top secret veracity back to Mar-a-Lago.
Sure, let's take that second point first, and that is that Merrick Garland is almost surely gathering around his conference table there on the seventh floor the leaders of the various investigations. Can we count them using Arabic numerals anymore? There are so many of them going on right now. And so he brings them together and he says, where are you? Where are you on January 6th? Where are you with other matters, electors? Where are you with all these other things now, including the Mar-a-Lago documents? And at some point, he has got to make the decision, depending upon where those investigations are, about timing. You're absolutely right about that. And you want to, if you will, you want to always put together the case that is as strong as possible. It is sort of flippant to say, if you're going to kill the king, you need to kill the king. But it's got to be a very strong case, that virtually jury-proof and compelling. And so when the general practice with the Department of Justice is you indict, you present charges when the case is ready to go, we usually present things to the grand jury when we've got evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, the attorney general has a lot of decision making to do, because it may well be that he's going to have that beyond a reasonable doubt evidence as to the Mar-a-Lago documents soon. Does he wait until the January 6th components? Other things are ready to go. That's a strategic decision he also needs to make, just because of what you identified. You can indict an individual on multiple different times, different charges. You don't just have to indict in one singular indictment. He could do that and charge down the road, but he's also got to be very much aware, which I think is where your question comes from, the notion you're doing this very much in the public domain. As for the election, yes, tick tock. There is an unwritten sort of 60-day rule inside the Department of Justice. You don't get inside that unless once you get, you've got a really compelling reason to do so. You've got to stop somebody from doing their engaging in their further criminal activity. That may well be in the mix here. And so I would not be completely shocked if there is some charge here, but it's also got to be taken from the perspective of the long view. My best guess is we won't see anything before the November midterms, but sometime in early 2023, yes.
James Santel, former U.S. attorney, about less than 2 minutes here. You know who's not in that meeting on the seventh floor is Fawnie Willis or Tish James or Alvin Bragg. And we have all these other things. Is there any coordination between those different law or agencies, let's call them, as it pertains to charging the same person?
Sure. Two kinds of coordination. One is it certainly is not only acceptable, but assumed that even state authorities will talk to federal authorities simply to give them heads up. This is what we're going to do. I'm going to indict. I'm going to charge tomorrow so that we're not stepping on each other. We're not executing search warrants on top of each other. Pure communication among leaders that can and should happen and does happen routinely. The other piece of this, of course, is that those are separate charges. And they could go at any time. Again, Fannie Willis in Fulton County, she could drop something much sooner. She doesn't have perhaps the global concerns that we just talked about that Merrick Garland does. And again, as you say, you've also got New York. You've got the attorney general there, the DA in Manhattan. They also have things pending. Those could drop at any time.
Jim Tintel, you got one more segment, man. You got time for one more.
Yeah. Always.
Dom has kind of been dominating this conversation as far as I'm concerned. And I got a few questions, sir. Our good friend and fine guest, former U.S. Attorney James Santel, you're listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the happier happy hour. It rolls on with a little more Jim. Let's call it extra credit coverage.
Very good.
Inappropriate. Stop it right now.
Who's WI.com?
The Devil's Advocates. Never personal. Only politics.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the Hump Day Edition. Rolling through the happier happy hour. Never selling out. We got the finest of guests. He is former U.S. Attorney James Santel. He is the host of his own fine program, Saturday Mornings, Morning Cannolis, 9 to 11 a.m. Jim Santel, thank you for sticking around because I feel like I am due a few questions. I'm so domineering.
I will recognize the gentleman in the red hat, yes.
I realize these paperwork crimes have taken a lot of you and Dom's attention, but there's a very significant coup attempt against the democracy we live in and the vice presidency. And it seems like we're taking our eye off the balls, ball boys. And here's my point, Jim, that is the more significant crime to my perception. I haven't seen everything, but the public reporting we've seen about the president's lawyers and the different tentacles of this multifaceted coup, Jim, that's what I want history to charge Donald Trump with. Whether or not the man ever does a day in prison, whether or not there is a conviction, whether some jury nullifies the charges against him in this case or another. But I care a lot less relative to the gravity of what I think happened about these other probable crimes that the DOJ has laid out in their filings. It's not that I don't care, Jim. It's that I think we only get one bite at the apple. I think there will only be one prosecution of Donald Trump effectively on a federal level. And if you're going to do it, man, you got to go for the big gig, not the ancillary crimes. My term, counselor.
And I think you're exactly right. And I think that that's probably what keeps Merrick Garland up at night. Attorneys general, as we all do, perhaps, think about their places in history. And whether it's 50 years from now or 100 years from now, when your grandchildren are writing about this and they say, well, gosh, he was a president who was charged and convicted for some document thing, as opposed to it was charged and convicted for trying to overthrow the government, that makes a difference. Absolutely. And so I think your point is well taken. It does not in any way diminish the fact that crimes were, in fact, committed plainly in Mar-a-Lago and in transit from the White House down there. And one of the options, again, that Merrick Garland would have, for example, were to not mothball this for a while, but as January 6th, as your advocacy takes hold, and he does, in fact, put together an indictment as to January 6th events and electors events and coordination with some of these groups events, all of that sort of thing, makes that the cornerstone of a major indictment. You can always still add two or three counts to that. It doesn't have to be intimately related factually or in terms of the narrative. You could add to that major indictment a couple accounts based upon these documents in Mar-a-Lago. You could do other things that are out there, make those maybe secondary, tertiary counts. That's also an option there. I think you're right in the sense that if he does break this up, as I maybe indicated before, he could do procedurally into first indictment, second indictment, third indictment, fourth, then you risk losing, if you will, the American public in the focus of it, which I think is your principal point. And you're no longer playing quite to the history on this. You want to identify those things that are significant. And you happen to have stumbled, my friend, upon something that's in the fundamental rules of federal prosecution, which is you charge the most readily provable, most serious crime out there. That has remained the Department of Justice's approach for as long as I was a part of it. And so Merrick Garland has that right in his inbox as well.
Jim, theoretically, the paperwork crimes, as I continue to call them, the classified documents, while they are substantial crimes, and it appears that the former president is guilty, at least the photographic evidence would seem to indicate. But Jim, if it was effectively a first offense, because as far as I know, Donald Trump's not a convicted felon of any sort, and this is a nonviolent act in the federal courts, I mean, this really would probably be some sort of a negotiated prosecution in some way, shape, or form. Would it not be, Counselor? Could you not see the former president pleading guilty and he'll do no crime and he'll get a slap on the wrist? That's my fear, Jim, is this will come off as something less than serious as a prosecution.
Right. And it goes to something we've talked about before called the sentencing guidelines. And those are numbers quite literally attached to the severity of the crimes which you've been convicted. You also bring into that things like your prior history, the impact of the crime that you engaged in. And so all of that then is wound up and presented to the judge. We've talked about the scope of the kinds of sentences that can be imposed. Here, I agree with you again that the seriousness of the insurrection counts would carry with them more points, more numbers, if you will, and get him into a higher sentencing guideline range. At the same time, if in fact the department shows, and they're looking at this right now, as Dom and I chatted earlier on this very hour, if it turns out that some of those materials did in fact compromise human intelligence and some of our serious foreign events and engagements overseas, if we have lost our spies overseas as a result of this, that ratchets up the seriousness of this a whole lot and makes a prosecution, even just on those counts, on the paper counts, a whole lot more serious under the sentencing guidelines than would otherwise be. All the more reason why Merrick Garland's got to track down every last aspect of this before he indicts on anything, including the documents out of Mar-a-Lago.
Jim, I'll join you in that asterisk. But otherwise, it's paperwork crimes.
Folks, we are the devil's advocates. That is James Santel, former U.S. attorney, friend of ours. Thanks for sticking around, Jim. I have so many issues with this. Number one, if I did any of this stuff, I'd be arrested already, right? So let's get to that point. Equal administration under the law, that kind of thing, right? Equal enforcement of law. I mean, so Donald Trump should already be arrested, as far as I'm concerned. Because if it were me, Jim, I have a feeling they would already have arrested me. Do you agree, sir?
I do. I think you would have been with this sort of evidence, you would have been taken into custody. You would probably released on your own recognizance because you're a decent guy otherwise, aside from having committed these offenses here. But you would be. There would be a criminal complaint put together and probably presented to the indictment, grand jury indictment, sometime within about 30 days. That process would be underway. Again, we are very much attentive to the fact that this is a former president, and so there's a lot of weight given to that.
Should we be, though, Jim? I mean, and this is my point. Should we be? So what if he's the former president? You know what? I mean, really, honestly, so frickin' what? What does that have to do with anything? If this is an elected position, you go in, you go out. If you're a former cop and you carry a gun, you're not supposed to carry a gun, or, you know, it doesn't matter. They'll arrest you. If you're a former surgeon, you don't have a license anymore, but you're still doing surgeries, they'll arrest you. I mean, being former doesn't make you it. So that bothers me. Obviously, Jim, you can tell it bothers me greatly.
And you're being bothered is appropriate, and my comment is simply about one of the factors the attorney general's got to think about in going down this presidential, unprecedented road, not precedented road, precedented road. Your point is, again, very well taken. Bob Mueller said in the last line of the Mueller report, no one is above the law. That's the way it should be. And I agree with you, in a perfect world where you didn't have to be concerned about an America that's going to respond positively and badly and someplace in between, when this former president is indicted, you didn't have to respond to that. And you know what? In the end, you shouldn't have to. Yeah, right. You're absolutely right. You shouldn't have to respond to that. I've said it before, I'll say it again, the decision not to prosecute because you're concerned about the political implications is as corrupt as a decision to prosecute premised upon politics. And so your point is well taken.
Thank you, Jim. One thing, I'll kick it back to Crudy here for the last few minutes. It seems to me, and we talk about, you know, the crimes that have been committed, things are being investigated, that the paperwork crime, these top secret documents and this particular issue that we're focusing on now, because, of course, January 6th committee has been meeting, they haven't had any hearings, so this is where we are, and this is, you know, of course, a big deal because the FBI raided the former president's house. It seems to me that this is the low-hanging fruit. The conspiracy and the insurrection and all those things, it seems more murky than the guy had documents, we wanted them back, he gave us some back, we found out he had more, we wanted them back, they said they gave us everything, they didn't, and you know, so from a prosecutorial perspective, it seems like this is a slam dunk case, but it's also taken a year and a half to get to this point. Could it take another year for the insurrection investigation, quote unquote, to unfold, that this is all of a sudden the low hanging fruit and the easiest way to keep him off the ballot if he is in fact convicted for this crime?
There's no doubt that the January 6th matter is much more, I'll use the word, expansive, right? You've got so many tendrils out there, so many places, so many things going on, news breaking every day about that. It is a much bigger, fatter file, if you will, that's sitting in Merrick Garland's inbox and continues to grow every day. So that's the challenge of doing all of this. The greater issue then is, and what timing? How do you sequence these things? And in the end, the other important point that's packed into your question is timing. Let's think about this. That Merrick Garland has a little bit more than 2 years, 20 months, maybe 22 months or so of his tenure. In January of 2025, he will no longer be the attorney general, depending upon who the next administration is. If you don't charge and you don't convict and you don't get the appeal done and you don't get the Supreme Court review completely done, the department in a new administration could, I'll say it out loud, could dismiss these charges as it did with some certain defendants in the last administration. Now, there'd be an outrage about that, and you'd have to get the right attorney general in there you get the wrong one in there. But the reality is, as long as it's pending, you can still dismiss those charges. And that's why time is of the essence. There's a lot to do in a little bit more than 2 years for Merrick Garland on all of these, including the so-called paper charges and the January 6th thing. This has got to be started sometime in early 2023 to get this nearly completed, if not fully completed, by the end of this term. And again, a Democrat, if Joe Biden is reelected, and that concern goes completely away. If there is a change in administration, that's when we begin to think about, gosh, what could be done legitimately under the law to dismiss charges already brought by a prior administration? That's the additional concern that's in your question, which again is so well articulated here today. It raises this prospect of timing.
Well, let me cast some shade on Dominic's poorly phrased question. It is not the DOJ's job to keep Donald Trump off the ballot. In no way, shape, or form should that ever factor into whether or not he's charged.
My personal opinion.
Well, your opinion's wrong in this case.
And you're right. You're right. The Attorney General's just issued another memorandum somewhat related about politics and officials. You're absolutely right. The Department of Justice, as we've said so many times, should not be guided by partisan politics about who's on the next ballot. It should be guided by what the law says, what the facts prove, and what when you are ready, again, based upon a reasonable doubt standard, to present this to a grand jury, to present this to a trial jury, when you're ready to go ahead, you do it. You don't wait around for illegitimate purposes or just other strategic purposes, and you don't do it just to keep somebody off the ballot. That's presumably somebody else's responsibility, right? Under the 14th Amendment, other procedures there. It's in the back of your mind, but first and foremost, it is about enforcing the law, which is what the chief federal law enforcement officer has got to do as he wrestles with all these things.
Jim Sintel, the former president, is currently leveling, I would call them, daily threats against the democracy. How is it the Department of Justice has not seen fit to go round this guy up and throw him in the clink and hold him until trial? I mean, anyone else making threats that could have the force of getting people killed would probably be charged with a little more alacrity, or am I wrong, counselor?
Right. You know, we do have the First Amendment out there, but it only goes so far. As we've talked before in connection with January 6th, these other things he is saying recently, undeniably, once again, inciting people who might not otherwise do this to pick up their, I hate to say it, guns, become violent. We know about the Cincinnati event. That's happened already. You're inciting people to do things they wouldn't otherwise do. Your First Amendment right to express your dismay with what the government does, including a search of your own property, only goes so far. It's called fighting words. It's called again, inciting people to violence. And you can make the argument, a very creative or not so creative prosecutor would say, yes, this is too much. Once again, you think long and hard about it just because this is a former president. But then again, should not be the dispositive factor here. Don't want to overemphasize that. And I think it is a part of the deliberation, the discussion that Merrick Garland is having around his conference room table on a regular basis these days.
Jim Santel, leave me time to say goodbye. Thank you so much, counselor, for joining us on the Devil's Advocates today.
Thank you, Jim. Always a pleasure, gentlemen. Take care.
Have to beat that off.
FBI, open up!
Hey, buddy.
Occupy didn't start on Wall Street. It started on our street. The Devil's Advocates.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show. Last segment of the day. If you got something to say, hit us up right now, 844-967-2789.
Dominic, let me thank our fine guest and good friend, former U.S. Attorney James Santel. If you like the kind of action you've been hearing on this show, you should tune in Saturday mornings for Morning Cannolis. You can hear them all across the Civic Media Network, in the Rapids, in Warsaw, in Waukesha, and right here in Madison on Devil Radio, Saturday mornings, 9 to 11 a.m. And also looking forward to the kickoff of the Badger football season on WFHR. I believe that's a 6:20 kick on Saturday night.
That's this week.
September 3rd.
Oh, Big Ten ball already starts on Saturday.
Awesome. Well, the Badgers are a Big Ten team. Illinois State, I don't think the two teams have ever met before.
Uh-oh.
On the gridiron. So we'll see. We'll see. 844-967-2789. Thanks, Jim. 844-967-2789. Corinna from Milwaukee, I believe. Corinna, welcome. What do you got for us?
Hi. I was just sharing an information. I got the letter today from the Board of Pharmacy saying that we have to retrain our pharmacists to make sure that we are releasing medication into different states with which will cause spontaneously abortion or damage of a fetus or whatever it is. So as you know, majority of medications do have that caution. So that is, I think it's just interesting that now, even though our state still have an abortion as is, we have to change what we do with the other states, and it's just a very sad situation.
Thank you for your call, Karina. 844-967-27. I wish I understood better. I would try to clarify. 844-967-2789. Doug from Minneapolis. Welcome, Doug. What do you got for us?
Hi, guys. Great show. I really enjoyed the interview with the attorney. It was very not only educational, but illuminating. I tuned in late, and I don't know if you guys touched on Lindsey Graham, what he said the other day. If you did, I don't want to necessarily repeat everything you've already said.
No, not today. Although we had Jim on relatively recently, we might have acknowledged the fact that Lindsey Graham effectively, and I know we did on the show, whether or not we did with Jim Santel, I don't recall clearly because I think we're all in the studio together on Friday, but you go, Doug.
Well, here's how I interpreted what Lindsey Graham said, and I'm a retired 36-year Marine who the people that Lindsey Graham referenced when he was not making a threat. In my mind, he was making a promise. That's how I looked at it. And the people that will show up in the streets, the majority of them probably will not have served in the military. They will, they have not pledged to support and defend the Constitution like all of us, you know, after each enlistment, during each enlistment, and all that. And Lindsey Graham basically was throwing a fireball. I think it was not just a threat, but a promise, and I'd like to know what you guys think about that.
Well, I just asked James Santel, the fine former U.S. attorney, our fine guest. It seems to me that Donald Trump's throwing some fireballs each and every day as well, Doug.
And absolutely.
These are inciting words. These aren't First Amendment free speech protected words. When you're effectively seeking to incite violence as a specific reaction, if someone's going to press charges against you, well, I can't tell you with clarity, Doug, why it is the DOJ is not picking up, be it Lindsey Graham, although I think that's perhaps more defensible slightly, or Donald Trump, which is not defensible at all, to my opinion, Doug, because the man is out there inciting violence or seeking to incite violence if he gets charged, and we all suspect he's about to get charged.
I agree with exactly how you just phrased it and how you couched it, because I think what Trump has said is much more dangerous. But what Lindsey Graham said was unconscionable for a sitting senator, somebody who does, after he is elected each time, swears allegiance to support and defend the Constitution. And what does he do the first chance he gets to get a little airtime? He throws out that fireball. And I believe in the First Amendment. I believe we should be able to express all our ideas, with the exception of yelling fire in a crowded auditorium, right? But there has to be, and I'm no lawyer, and I just wish there was somebody that had a clearer answer about whether or not what Lindsey Graham actually crossed the line. Well, and could be charged.
Doug, let me ask you, as a lawyer, Lindsey Graham is a JAG officer.
Exactly. Right.
So he is effectively exactly. An attorney in the military, and that would set him up for a differing standard of service. Not only has he, as a U.S. senator, pledged an oath to the U.S. Constitution, but also as an officer in the military, and above and beyond that, he is an officer of the court as a JAG officer.
He's also a politician, and it's not the first time someone said, "Oh, if XYZ happens, there's going to be riots in the streets." Well, I share the concern, no doubt, but I mean, come on, it's a call to arms, I guess, in the same way that the Republicans are always prodding their base. But to think that he is actually calling for that out loud and saying, come and attack this country. I mean, it's hyperbole, Doug.
No, that was Doug. Doug, that was Trump at the Ellipse on January 6th, actually saying it aloud.
You're going to lose your country versus, if XYZ happens, there's going to be riots in the streets. I have a problem with it, Doug, but it's still free speech.
I didn't mean to imply that he said the way you just explained it. He did not imply that this is exactly what's going to happen if you do this and you do that. The way he said it, he probably protected himself and knows how to do it. But I think it was more of a promise than a threat. And yes, he was a JAG lawyer in the Air Force for 30-some years. I mean, the guy, a long time.
Doug, we prefer the term JAG officer.
Hey, real quick, and thank you, Doug, for the call. And Evan, real quick, Karina, our last call, kind of get through out of left field. Apparently, she was referring to the pharmacist in Wisconsin must now note whether a medication carried a risk to a fetus when meds are sent across state lines. You know, more of that kind of weird action going on. The result of the overturning of Roe v. Wade and all these other laws. So thank you, Karina, for that. Sorry we didn't quite get the grasp of it. Thank you for listening.
Thank you to James Santel. Thank you to everyone that listened today. Don't forget, stick around, because we got Native Roots Radio. Then I believe we got a Up North News podcast with Kirk Bankstead and Pat Kreitlow, although Kirk's on vacation, so who knows what they're playing at 7. Keep her locked. We'll all find out together.
I want somebody's butt. I want it now. I got it.
And they weren't there for him. They were there for me.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.